Thanks for joining us for this Views and Brews podcast, recorded live at the Cactus Cafe in Austin, Texas. We hope you enjoy the show.
Follow that. Cold open. One of a couple we've seen. Hello, everyone. Welcome to the Cactus Cafe this evening for a Views and Brews on jazz and the art of popularity. It's wonderful to see everybody out tonight. I'm Rebecca McEnroe with KUT. First of all, thank you, Red Young. That was beautiful. Thank you. I wanted to start with a quote that I heard. I was reading a couple weeks ago, Susan Sontag's On Photography. Anyone? And it was so fascinating because, you know, she talks a lot about the growing importance of photography in our lives and the growing importance of the image. And this quote jumped out at me, and it's from November 15th, 1861. It's from the journals of Jules and Edmond de Goncourt. And they write, "I sometimes think the day will come when all modern nations will adore a sort of American God, a God who will have been someone who lived as a human being and about whom much has been written in the popular press. Images of this God will be set up in the churches, not as the imagination that each individual painter will fancy him, not floating on a Veronica cloth, but fixed once and for all by photography. Yes, I foresee a photographed God wearing spectacles." And I love that quote. I love that quote because it shows how we pay attention to these things that we kind of are fascinated with. And we might not think it has a huge impact, but it does. And so tonight, as we talk about jazz and the art of popularity, we'll consider that and just keep it in the back of our minds, what we look at, what we pay attention to. And as Simone Weil says, attention is a form of prayer. So how we maybe create gods in our lives. And here with me to do that, hopefully he'll come up on stage eventually, is rabbi and jazz historian Neil Blumhoff. Welcome.
Thanks. Did somebody say prayer?
You know more about that than I do.
So, hey everybody. How you doing? Glad that we're here, and thank you for that beautiful introduction, and Red Young also. That's called The Easy Winners, everyone. That's by Scott Joplin. And we chose that piece because it's a little bit different than what we normally do. It was written and published in 1901, and it was written about a horse race. It's written about talking about how we deify athletes or celebrities. And it talks a little bit about how, in the work that we do, how we set up others in these images that we were talking about, and how that can be questioned. So as we enter into this space now, we're going to do things a little bit differently today. Is that okay with everybody?
Yeah.
Beautiful. So as we deliberate and think about the celebrities or those in authority in front of us now, and the reliabilities of polling, and the ways that we... Because we're talking about Downbeat Magazine and the history of Downbeat Magazine, of course. What do you think I was talking about? Prayer is a form of code. And as we talk a little bit about the jazz scene, hopefully we can tonight think in jazz and allow us to begin to think about new associations and new ways to make sense of, or perhaps just come to a sense of equanimity within our world. Before we do that, though, it's been a difficult week for many, many people, and we wanted to invite up Roscoe Beck to come up. Roscoe is an incredible bass player, wonderful musician, and he's going to speak for a minute or two about what he's thinking about right now, and then he's going to play, which fits perfectly with our presentation this evening, a song that was made popular by Benny Goodman called Memories of You, and then we'll take it from there. So we're going to skedaddle for a minute, and Roscoe's going to come up and play Memories for You, which I hope that is important for all of us, and then we'll see what happens. Roscoe?
I've been kind of speechless for about a week at the passing of a dear friend of mine, Mr. Leonard Cohen, last Monday. And Neil suggested maybe we could play something of Leonard's, which still a little raw for me. So I suggested the Benny Goodman tune, which is called Memories of You. And I will preface it with a melody of Leonard's in which the words are spoken, forget your perfect offering, and believe me, it won't be. So I've got an out already, which is good. Leonard also said there is a crack in everything. That's how the light gets in.
So as we think about the images and those in our lives for which we hold on to for reassurance, for reminding us that we're not alone, Roscoe, I know, if you don't know, Roscoe is a longtime friend and longtime collaborator with Leonard Cohen, was his music director on a few of his, certainly, I mean, a few tours, 37? His musical director for 37 years. And actually, I first met Roscoe in Los Angeles in 2007 when I happened to be taking a particular course with a rabbi friend, teacher of mine, and Mr. Cohen and Roscoe were there, and I had a chance to connect to Mr. Cohen a little bit and to appreciate the possibilities of how, in this case Judaism, but how spiritual life or how religion, if you will, can be translated in a way that is timeless and can speak to the human condition. So I had the opportunity over the years to connect a little bit with Mr. Cohen, and I contacted him just before Yom Kippur, about a month or so ago, just to wish him well on his new release, and he responded with a beautiful blessing for me. And what I'd like to do, if it's all right with you, well, we're going to do it anyway, but what I'd like to do is I'd like to offer, here in Austin, at least now, at this moment, the traditional Jewish prayer for his soul. It's called the El Male Rachamim, and I'd like to invite our dear friends to come forward to join Roscoe. Is Scott Lanningham on drums? Is Michael Malone on saxophone? David Young on trumpet? And Red Young on piano? So traditionally this prayer is recited when people stand, but if you don't feel comfortable doing that, that's fine. But if you'd like to stand, that'd be fine. And this poem, or this prayer, just essentially speaks about the soul of the one that we love and ask for him to be reunited with that which is infinite, and may his work that he has done in this world be work that is helps us. And perhaps a quote that might be helpful to each of us as we think about it would be something that that we can analyze and think about our own life. As Horace Mann said, for us to be ashamed to die until you have won some victory for humanity. And you'll hear a little bit, you'll hear Leonard's name in Hebrew, which is, his Hebrew name is Eliezer, which is, and the son of Nissan, HaKohen, the son of Nissan, the Kohen. So Eliezer ben Nissan HaKohen. So here it is. Thank you.
בסתר כנפיך בעולמי. וצרור ביצרור, וצרור ביצרור, החיים את נשמתו.
So let's talk a little bit. We're going to open up this discussion about popularity, about who we are and what we are, what we think we like. If you guys, you know, you guys like Miles Davis, right? Right? How many of the Miles Davis? What do you think? That's about half of you. That's fine. But do we know Miles Davis? What do we like about Miles Davis? What do we consider to be popular? What do we consider to be our preferences? Every time we click on whatever and we get that specialized advertisement just for us, right? How are we getting fed our information? So as long as the gentlemen are still here, why don't we begin with thoughts about popularity and being honored. And we're going to start with a tune that was made popular by Louis Armstrong, who, by the way, in 1952, won the first readers' poll of Downbeat Magazine. So Downbeat Magazine was a media that was started in 1934, and they started got around to doing readers' polls in 1952, and they started doing critics' polls, because, you know, critics have to have a voice too, in 1961. And they used to do all sorts of different polls. We could talk about this for a long time. They used to do swing versus sweet bands. Sort of sweet bands were a little bit sort of more like easy listening. So they did from 1930s, they did a swing band of the year and a sweet band of the year. But they discontinued that, just food for thought, in 1946, when Duke Ellington actually won both categories. Swing band of the year and sweet band of the year, and people seriously wrote in and they thought the election was rigged. It's true. It's actually very true. So this song is called Ain't Misbehavin'. Comes from 1929, and again, Louis Armstrong, the first readers' poll winner, and written by lots of people, Andy Razaf, with music by Fats Waller and Harry Brooks. And it was a theme for an off-Broadway play that maybe you've seen, Connie's Hot Chocolates. Anybody seen that one? Okay. Yes. Right, exactly. The more things change. So in Armstrong solo, I was telling this to David before, the Armstrong solo, he was in the orchestra pit playing for this production, and it happened that Satchmo was playing, and the crowd sort of forgot about the musical, and they asked Louis Armstrong to come up on stage, because they loved his solo on Ain't Misbehavin' so much. No pressure, David.
No, it's all right.
So, just saying that. So I hope that you enjoy this, and then we'll think about what all this means. So, David Young and our wonderful ensemble playing Ain't Misbehavin'. Thank you. That's David Young there on the trumpet. You did, man. You came up from the pit. We all need to come up from the pit and play our solo. Well done. Michael Malone on saxophone. Well done. Breaking out the soprano saxophone. A little Sidney Bechet of you, my friend. Nice, beautiful. Scott Lanningham on drums. Red Young on piano. Roscoe Beck on bass. So we'll be back in a minute. You guys can take a seat and we'll... So that was pretty great. High bar. So they'll be back in a few minutes. We're just going to sort of put this music in context a little bit. Oh, hey, Rebecca. Did somebody say prayer?
I'm back, suckers. That was pretty cool.
Yep.
Yeah. So, you know, you started talking about the downbeat jazz pulls, and tell me why those came to your mind.
So downbeat. Anybody get downbeat?
Yep. Still? Yeah? Yeah? Right there.
All right, beautiful. So who was that, Michael? All right, beautiful. Anybody else? You can get the Downbeat app for your phone. But when it came out, it was actually founded by a guy named Albert Lifshultz. Excellent. And... and he and he was living in Chicago. Excellent. Anybody? Can we just... All right, we're just getting happy. All right, 108 years. Anybody on that one? Come on now. Come on now. The world is going to be okay. Every 108 years is going to get better. So Albert Lifshultz, he sold insurance. Okay, right? I mean, what else do you expect Albert Lifshultz to be doing? But he sold insurance to Chicago musicians. And he was there at the Century of Progress Exposition. Anybody been there? 1934? Okay. And he had this great idea. He's like, you know, I have this idea, and I'm going to sort of get the word out about this wonderful group that's here in Chicago at the time, like Gene Krupa, Woody Herman, Benny Goodman, and this jazz that's emerging out of these swing bands and sweet bands. And he started his own little magazine called Downbeat Magazine. And as it says in Downbeat, it says, Downbeat Magazine is a place to instruct, recommend, criticize, praise, condemn, advocate, and honor. It's about shaping and challenging tastes. So that's what he started to do, and he started out. And all of a sudden, he got a phone call from James Petrillo, who is the president of Local 10 of the American Federation of Musicians, saying, cease and desist. So Lifshultz, being a nice man, I believe, he sold his interest in Downbeat and said, okay. So he stopped. But then a lot of people started coming up, but Carl Lynn Kahns, he's going to come back in a minute, but he became the business manager. And together with Benny Goodman, that we heard just before, they launched the swing era in 1935. So if you remember, we did a Benny Goodman show. Anybody was there for that one? Yeah. Two
John,
of us.
You were.
It was a lot of seats available. So at the Palomar Ballroom in Los Angeles, anybody remember that, 1935, the Coast to Coast Radio? All right, good. Well, you know, you got to know your audience. And it launched Goodman as a national star, and along with Downbeat Magazine. So anyway, so Downbeat Magazine, back to your thing. The critics' polls and the readers' polls actually didn't come out for another roughly 20 years after it began, but they were searching for a way to publicize and popularize jazz. So they began to attract all these wonderful writers. So some of the first writers were Leonard Feather, Stanley Dance, and very importantly, John Hammond. John Hammond, who discovered Bob Dylan and did some work with Leonard Cohen as well in the mid-70s. But they established, and this is to your point, they established who was an insider and who was an outsider, who was in the know and who wasn't in the know. So when Michael said, yeah, I get downbeat, didn't all of us feel a little bit worse about ourselves? Just a little bit. So I told you about the readers, the polls about the swing band, whatever. So that happened, but... they wanted to expand, and they became, just to your point, they became part of the national focus, especially in the late 30s, when records and radio and movies came out just to sort of form a national culture, of course, which was sharpened in World War II. So I don't know if you all have been over to the Bullock Museum for the current exhibit about propaganda. But the idea that what we imbibe or what we just see on billboards as we or on subways or buses or wherever we go shape our tastes even without us knowing it. And I think the early founders of Downbeat were very concerned and very interested in bringing their, if you will, product of jazz into the world and negotiating it between, at least in the 30s, between so-called sweet music and swing music. So the polls, the readers' polls and the critics' polls that we're choosing came out of that idea once they realized in the 50s that swing music was no longer a thing. Because they were riding high, and then in the 50s they're like, we have to change our business model because the popularity is moving away from what we're selling.
You know, it's so fascinating to me. I mean, just the ways in which we understand what we trust and what we don't trust, you know, and we're looking for things. And a couple of years ago I was talking to Roscoe about a poet, Wisława Szymborska. And I know Leonard knew her, and we're both big fans. And she has this great poem about maps, where she says, and I'll read it, I'm not like, you know, some kind of genius.
We expect more.
Exactly. Flat as a table it's placed on, nothing moves beneath it, and it seeks no outlet. Above, my human breath creates no stirring air and leaves its total surface undisturbed. Nations' borders are barely visible, as if they wavered to be or not. I like maps because they lie, because they give me no access to the vicious truth, because great-heartedly, good-naturedly, they spread before me a world not of this world.
Yes. So, pursuant to that, so here we are at Downbeat Magazine in 1930, whatever, right? And you've got this new publisher, you've got this new editor, and he's Carl Kahns. So he's walking by the copy desk. Any writers in here? Okay, cool. So he's walking by the copy desk and he looks over the shoulder of the people writing the stories. And maybe this can juxtapose to our time, perhaps. And he's looking at it, and he shakes his head, and he goes like, no, give me that pen, okay? And this is, again, in the late 30s when swing, and he draws a picture of Benny Goodman and Artie Shaw, both very important and popular musicians at the time. And then above that picture of Benny Goodman and Artie Shaw, he wrote the headline, and he said, Shaw stabs Goodman with a paring knife. And then he said, write that in the magazine, or vice versa, it doesn't really matter. The idea is to sell copy. Do that, and that's what this magazine is all about. Pen drop. So the idea of what do we trust, and we don't trust maps, or we don't, the idea of the unreliability of the borders or the boundaries that we put for ourselves, I think has a very long history about how we're trying to shape tastes, both in your face, but also in the very subtle ways as we speak, in the subtle ways that the world works as well.
So what are we going to hear next?
Oh, a couple things.
People come for music.
No, do you guys just come for the music? Is that it?
Well, you know, let's be honest. Let's be honest.
No. Do you come also to hear Rebecca hold forth? Yeah. McEnroy stabs Blumhoff with a paring knife.
Or vice versa.
So we're going to hear a couple of tunes. We're going to continue. I wanted to do a sort of a sampling of the readers and critics polls. So we heard just Ain't Misbehavin', which was the first recipient, Louis Armstrong, of the first readers poll. And now we're going to hear a song that was written by Duke Ellington in 1944, but popularized because these albums were coming out. And then in 1961, which was the first critics poll, the big winner of the first critics poll was Coleman Hawkins. So we're going to feature Michael Malone on I'm Beginning to See the Light. And some people believe that I'm beginning, what is that about? Some people believe that the inspiration for this song, I'm Beginning to See the Light, was Ellington's recent initiation into Freemasonry. Just saying. So if we can allow ourselves to recognize that. So we're going to go from there, from 1961, when Coleman Hawkins won the critics' poll, to 1962, when the readers' poll winner finally was Miles Davis. And we're going to hear a tune called Round Midnight, which was written by Thelonious Monk, also in 1944. See what I did there? You know, you're not paying attention. Rebecca McEnroy, ladies and gentlemen. You're just talking. So 1944, Thelonious Monk. By the way, Round Midnight, fun fact, I'll take Views and Brews for 800. The most recorded jazz standard composed by a jazz musician. So you can think about that. So, and then Miles Davis made this, of course, his signature song. So we're going to hear these two songs, both from 1944, one featuring Coleman Hawkins, one featuring Miles Davis, the first Critic Poll winner, and Miles Davis in 1962, the Reader's Poll. So let us please welcome up our wonderful musicians, Michael Malone on saxophone, David Young on trumpet, Roscoe Beck on bass, Scott Lanningham on drums, and Red Young on piano. Check it out. So here's the thing. I said to David, now you have to sound like Miles Davis in addition to Louis Armstrong. He goes like, I got this. I can do that. Yes, sir. Goodbye.
Thank you.
Scott Lanningham on drums. Roscoe Beck on bass. Red Young on piano. David Young on trumpet. Michael Malone on saxophone. So I've been thinking a little bit about that as we honor, you know, the winners of the polls and the people who, you know, get the awards and all that. So we're thinking about, you know, Coleman Hawkins and Miles Davis. But we put those tunes together to highlight a particular year. Now, I don't know about you if you're a student of history, but 1944 was not the greatest year ever. It just wasn't a really good year. And just to hear the richness of creativity and imagination that was coming out of responses like Thelonious Monk, for example, or Duke Ellington, the ways that they, in their own lives of privation, their own lives of feeling the racism that was just inherent in what was, and also, of course, looking out at the world and saying, what do we do now, 1944, what do we do now? And I don't know about you, and if you haven't had a chance to see this or view this, you might want to, but there's a commentator out, John Oliver. Do you know John Oliver? Okay. So John Oliver, in his last show of this season, which just aired on Sunday, had comments, obviously, about, you know, the current events and the election. And did anybody see that episode? Yeah. So he ended the episode with, you know, various celebrities and other people on the street, telling 2016, I cannot say as a clergyman, but, you know, they were particular hand signals. And he ended this, if you saw it, if you didn't, he ended it with a scene sort of typecast from Die Hard, you know, having 2016 in sort of dynamite, and he blew it up and he sort of walked away self-importantly. And I think, Rebecca, that was, you know, I'm a big fan of John Oliver, but my heart sank, not because of the profanity, but that also, but not because of the profanity, but because of the responses of certainly encouraging people to do what they needed to do, but he blew up the year. And that, to me, left me with a very sad feeling of oblivion, which I normally have, but which was a little bit more, and I'm going to tell you, and I'm going to challenge you, that to me it was a mistake. It was a big mistake when all of us are so tender, no matter where you are at Spectrum, I'm not trying to do that. All of us are sort of looking around in the world and whatever, wherever you are, with a lot of unease, for we live in unprecedented times, parentheses 1944. And then he sees, unlike Thelonious Monk and Duke Ellington, the need to blow it up and say, I got nothing more to say, boom. I think it's a mistake. Horace Mann said, the greatest trap in our life is not success, popularity, or power, but self-rejection.
Yeah, I would say perhaps self-rejection, but I also think...
When you look at Thelonious Monk and Duke Ellington in 1944, who could have done all sorts of things, but said, I'm beginning to see the light.
Well, it's always a process of becoming, but also that becoming is letting go. You know, sometimes you need to let go.
I get catharsis.
As Terry Eagleton said, the only way to emancipate yourself is to free yourself from yourself, you know, politically. The only way to get out of that struggle is to let go and to say, see you later, 2016, and to move forward and to figure out the moment that we're in, to try to understand it and to confront it for what it is and then move forward.
I don't disagree, yet it was his last show and the denouement had no resolution. That you were left with, okay, thanks, John Oliver. See you in, you know, March.
Well, Zizek said he would sell his mother into slavery to see what happened after the revolution. So I agree, there is no kind of afterward, but still.
I agree, and I think the frustration, but as a popular figure, as one who has a responsibility, I think it's very important for us to have conversations like this. And as we talk about popularity and about ways of sort of responding to the world around us, I think that Downbeat magazine also did the very same thing. And the guy who came to the fore was this aforementioned John Hammond. And he began to look around the world and he began in his writings to bring politics and racism together. And here's how he attacked racism. This is extraordinary. Michael Malone, you might have read this in a past issue. He was talking about Duke Ellington and this was in the, this is really in the 40s. He speaks about Duke Ellington and he criticizes Duke Ellington. He says about Duke Ellington shuts his eyes to the abuses being heaped upon his race. He conscientiously keeps himself from thinking about such problems as those of the Southern sharecroppers, the Scottsboro boys, intolerable working and relief conditions in the North and South. Consequently, Ellington's music has become vapid and without guts. And this kind of rallying point for where do we get our authority? Where, and we can argue about all sorts of ideas that are before us about fear and uncertainty and all those things. Perhaps the thing that is happening now for all of us just beneath our eyes is the devaluation of symbols, the devaluation of offices and of authority, which to me is beyond fear. And I know we talk about how fear is banal and it just happens, but once we start deconstructing our authority figures or the places where we gain trust, and once we are without trust, I think our world becomes, as you were saying, much more dark with our box of darkness growing every day.
Agree to disagree. We're not, just kidding. There is a lot there, and we will continue with our discussions of Views and Brews. But for now, we want to open things up to your questions.
We do in just a second.
What?
Actually, we do in a second.
Gosh, and I are just having a night.
Because this is really funny. No, this is fun. Because so here's how things are changing. How do you describe the world? Just this one thing.
Okay, one thing.
Because it's fantastic. So they're like, so Downbeat's like, what do we do? How do we respond to people jazz? Because they're stressing about people like Elvis Presley and things like that. So in 1949, they hold a contest to see what is the best word to replace jazz. They're like, we're going to like empower people to think about like what's the best word. So they wanted to coin a new word to describe, as they call it, describe the music from Dixieland through bop. So they had a public contest. This might remind you of Bodie McBoatface, right? Just saying. But so they had a few entries. Think about it. We're going to maybe we'll start with questions with that. So here's a few entries that did not make it. So how do you describe jazz? So people wrote in and they said, let's call it jarb. Freestyle, mesmerism, Bix Ebop, Bix like Bix Biederbeck, blip, and my favorite, schmoozik. But none of those won. And I invite you to think about your own ideas about how do we make sense of the changing world around us. The winner in 1949 to replace jazz, and thank God it did not win. The most, you ready? Crew cut. Exactly. America was a weird place in the 40s. So Crew Cut was the winner. And I don't think that helped them with Elvis Presley at all.
All opinions are welcome, but not all are valid. That's all I have to say. So let's open things up to some questions, and then we'll have some final tunes for the night.
This is a question about what you had said earlier about how when we're on our subway or on the bus and seeing media and how that affects our perception of things, and also about the gentleman that you mentioned about how he said, oh, just pit this guy against this guy and then write a headline about it, or do it vice versa. And then also self-rejection. Because I think, I know I'm guilty of media, like blaming media for shading our perception of things, but I think media is also a place that comes from humans, and they're tapping into what a lot of they think humans would feel like or believe in or a perspective that they would have. So I think rejecting what we see on the billboards or on the subway or a headline of a magazine is also a form of self-rejection, because it's a human that's trying to tap into what a lot of maybe humans might see. So it's not really a question.
Oh, I think that's interesting, and that may be, and I think that the response might be that we have to be present and aware of actually what we're seeing and imbibing, because even though it's a human response, a magazine headline, for example, everyone has an agenda, whether it's conscious or subconscious, and we just should be careful not to get sucked into a vortex, into a world that is far beyond ours. So again, sort of knowing what we stand for and what we're willing to do, I think would help us perhaps to agree with or even to withstand those kinds of subliminal messages that we get every day, while allowing all the while that it is human and of course necessary. But I think if we allow ourselves a chance to sort of check in with ourselves and say, why are we reacting? I mean, I don't know if anybody lived in New York, but what's that guy, the dermatologist, Jonathan Zisler or whatever? Zismore. When he died, man, people were upset because he was the advertising king in the subway. And did anybody know about Jonathan, whatever? The idea that we become, that we think we know people, or we think we have a relationship with the writer or the advertiser or the product that we have, I think even though human is still an illusion.
But I think it's more than that. I think that we really...
Of course you do.
Of course. I think we like to predict. As, we like to predict what's going to be.
As Abraham Lincoln said...
Shut up. You're the worst. You're the worst. But I think, you know, we like to predict our future. We gravitate toward things which are familiar to us, which is why polls, we love polls.
We love polls.
And we love popularity because it, like, it makes us feel safe because we can predict what's coming next. You
until
know?
We and can't.
Until we can't. Well, the fiction is, right, the mythology is that we ever can. But it gives us a sense that we can predict.
Well, it's also that, so if we're meeting at a party and we try to find common interests or whatever, and we could say, you like Miles Davis? I like Miles Davis. And then we both don't really know anything about Miles Davis. So we're just like, cool.
We could eat that, soup.
Right. Well, the point is that I think that popularity in polls, I agree, but it gives us a superficial understanding of things.
Exactly. That's
and I don't think we should be satisfied with that. Yeah. I think we should check in and say, well, why do I say that I like Miles Davis or the color blue or whatever? Why is that important to me? And to be accountable and complicit in the choices that we make. That's all I'm saying.
Wouldn't that be fabulous? That's fabulous. That would be fabulous. Go ahead, John.
So I'd also like just to... A moment of silence here for the great Mose Allison, who passed today. Your mind is on vacation, but your mouth is working overtime. The great 89-year-old. But what I wanted to ask, and I actually wanted to ask some of the artists to stand up, because there is this dynamic tension between an artist and a critic. You really like the criticism when it says you're an awesome player, and this is one of the greatest shows I've ever heard, and you hate his guts when he picks you apart. And so it's the love-hate thing, and it's existed for as long as there's been media. I'd like to hear some of these great musicians talk about your relationship with critics.
Well, before we do that too, John, no, seriously, because I was going to bring, but it's actually much more complicated than that, because many of the critics are actually responsible for the work that is produced also. So at least in the downbeat, I think that's very valid and we'll do that, but the critics who were writing reviews of the music, at least in the jazz world in the mid-20th century, were actually producing the records also. So just keep that in mind.
Anyone?
Red Young!
Well, actually, I never had a lot of faith in critics because a lot of them really don't know. You know, there was a show that I did with a lady named Joan Armatrading, and two critics came to the show. One of them hated it. The other one thought it was the greatest show they'd ever seen. So I just... You know, you really can't trust them unless you know what their level of intelligence is or what they're listening to or what they had for dinner that night or if they had a fight with their girlfriend.
Right, and their hidden agendas of what both a negative and a positive review will do that has nothing to do with the music itself. Right. So anybody, I mean, it's an important point. But the critics, Red, wouldn't you say, maybe not especially now when there's no authority in what we read and we're sort of micro-marketed, but they are the tastemakers, right? We may not know Ira Gittler, for example, but we sure do know that John Coltrane played with sheets of sound. There it is. And the idea of sheets of sound was sort of out of the imagination. We may not know, you know, the critics that we appreciate or don't, but yet they're the ones who sort of, whether it's fair or not, have the last say. So,
I mean, a lot of it is that people really don't know what they're listening to, a lot of it, you know. So they trust someone to give them the idea of this is cool, what you're listening to, but do they really know, you know?
Right, and then it becomes a cult of style and a cult of, well, everybody else is doing it, and I don't, like Rebecca was saying, I don't want to miss the boat, and this seems to be fashionable, so I'm going to get on, and I don't really know what I'm doing, but nobody knows what they're doing anyway.
And especially in jazz. especially in jazz, you know, it's like everything changes. I mean, the question about Ornette Coleman for decades, you know, is he really playing something serious or is he jiving everybody? You know, and the critics went over and around and around about that for decades.
And so did the musicians. Well, it's funny that you should mention Ornette Coleman in 1959 when he came out. Actually, Downbeat devoted a whole issue to that, and all of the reviews were, of course, negative with the exception of one. And the one guy was like, nope, this is the thing, and he got castigated among his peers and whatever. But I think it's an interesting idea, but yet the tastemakers ultimately are, you know, and I think you're right, the artificiality of it all and the seen and the unseen of what there is. But let me just say this is the first rule of being a clergyman, by the way. No, it's true. The ones who are the most friendly to you, the ones who are coming up to you and tell you that they love you and do you, are the ones who are going to betray you first. No, I'm serious. Because the ones who say, you're the best, when it's inevitable that you will disappoint them, are the ones who are going to be more disappointed than they should be, if that makes any sense. So the sense of this equanimity, the sense of a measured response or a golden rule of being in between these feelings of contempt and praise, I think is a healthy practice for all of us to do.
What did Allen Ginsberg say? Are you being sinister or is this some kind of practical joke? let's take one more question before we have the final pieces.
I've been thinking tonight about call and response, both in the sense of dialogue, of spiritual traditions, and with what we're faced with right now, finding our callings and finding our responses. And I think that, you know, when you have an artist, they want to have some kind of dialogue with people. They want to have an audience response. They have a calling. I guess I'm just curious, I can throw this to the musicians as well, like how you balance that with ego, that dialogic craving, that hunger for audience, that natural conversation with something that gets a little, because I think what you were talking about with John Oliver was a kind of nihilism, like an end to the conversation that felt violent and unfair.
It just didn't leave a sense of saying, well, now what? Because we don't have the luxury of blowing up 2016. I don't want to blow up 2016, nor do I want to blow up as unfortunate as 1944 was. No, seriously, but the idea of what do you do with the imperfections, as Roscoe was saying before? And I think it's an important conversation. Just, there was an article that came out yesterday by Leon Wieseltier, who is was a good friend of Leonard Cohen's for a very long time. And he characterizes Leonard Cohen, just based on what you were saying, as balancing a sense of absurdity with a sense of significance. He called him a lyrical advocate of the finite and the flawed renegade enamored of tradition. So we certainly would love to hear this idea, and I think maybe what you might be asking, perhaps, I don't want to, you know, but would be that for us to struggle to confer a moral integrity upon any exclamation of praise that we bring out, about any sort of offering that we give, what is it rooted in and what is its agenda, as we were talking about before. So anybody want to do this, since it was awesome? Thank you, Scott.
This all makes me think about a quote that I often share with friends that I found from the great choreographer Martha Graham that I love. You know, and just a thought on critics. I mean, I think they're entertainers too, just like musicians, you know. So you kind of take what you want, but it's all subjective, you know, it truly is. But Martha Graham, in so many words, I think, to a student, said, each of us is unique. There's only one of us in all of time. There never will be another one of me. And it's my job not to compare or to contrast with others' expression or to judge how good it is, but is simply to be open to being who I'm supposed to be. And that thought has made me a better musician whenever I think about it, and a better person.
So as we consider sort of where we are in the space and time, the call and response of where we are, by the way, there's a really beautiful Jewish saying to exactly that. I'm just saying, I'm not trying to Jewish-splain anything. I'm just saying that it's an old, just joking. But it's not about what we do with the world around us, the propaganda or whatever. So it's a guy named Zusia who's living and is about to die, right? It's the same thing. And his students come up to him and say, Reb Zusia, you're about to die. You're going to see Moses and David and all these amazing people. How could you have not been like more compassionate than Abraham or more of a leader than Moses? And Zusia is sort of lying on his deathbed and he opens his eyes all of a sudden. He says, when I'm about to die right now, the question I'm not going to be asked is, how could you have been more like Abraham or Moses? The question God is going to ask me is, Zusia, how could you have been more like Zusia? And then he dies. So, amen. So, what do we do with the world we're in? Let's not blow it up. Okay? Okay? What do we do with the world we're in? And I think we create beautiful music, and I think we create beautiful relationships, and we do as Downbeat challenges us to do, to praise and to condemn, to advocate and to honor. And as we hear these last tunes, unless there's more, then we'll hear how tastes are made, especially as we belong or strive to belong to something that we think is worthwhile.
Well, there's, yes.
One. Thank you, Mom. Appreciate it.
Thank you, Mom. You know, there's one thing. I brought this up in previous Views and Brews because I love this quote. But, you know, Susan Sontag was putting on a play, Waiting for Godot in Sarajevo, right? And she's putting on this play, and one of the journalists came and asked the theater director, like, why would you ever put on a play during wartime? Like, what is the point of that? Everybody, you know, is fighting for their lives. Why would you ever put on a play? And the theater director said, you know, the fallacy is that during wartime, the mission is to stay alive, but it's actually to remain human in each moment. And I think it's really something to take away, how we remain human in each moment and what we go to remind us that we are human beings.
Yes. Thank you. And to have that living witness, just plug in something else, just out of the... So Sunday afternoon at my place at Agudas Achim, we're actually having a group called the Holocaust Survivors Band play. One guy's 89, one guy's 91. And the idea of making art, specifically what you're saying, to humanize the experiences that we're in, irrespective of dying or living. And that would be something that we'll see to bring, unfortunately, 1944 to bear in our experiences.
So what are we going to hear?
So I pride myself in the Views and Brews to not repeat songs. So I had a song that was going to be repeated. I felt a little bad about myself, actually. So we're not going to do that one. Okay? We've never repeated a song here. So we're going to hear one song that was the recipient in 1986 of the Reader's Poll. Stan Getz was the winner of the Reader's Poll, and he had a jazz samba or bossa nova sort of revolution in the 60s. We're going to hear the song Desafinado, written by Antonio Carlos Jobim. And it was a hit for Getz in 1962, and he played it for a very, very long time. And then we're going to end with a really beautiful number that finally was recognized by the readers in 1996, Horace Silver, who wrote a beautiful tune, one of my favorites, also in 1959 when Ornette Coleman was doing his thing, called Sister Sadie. So we're going to end with a sort of a bossa nova number, Desafinado, and then we're going to end with a bebop, sort of an uptune called Sister Sadie, because we want you humming Sister Sadie, not the El Male Rachamim. Okay? So we'll introduce, although it's important to keep them both in your heart, actually. So, hey, our musicians, everybody. We've got Scott Lanningham on drums, Roscoe Beck on bass, Red Young on piano, Michael Malone on saxophone, and David Young on trumpet.
is a crack, a crack in everything. That's how the light gets in.
You've been listening to A Views and Brews, recorded live at the Cactus Cafe in Austin, Texas, for KUT Radio. You'll find a complete archive of all of our Views and Brews in the iTunes store, or go to KUT.org for more information. Thanks for listening.